In the shadow of slavery and silence, there was rhythm. In the heat of the Caribbean sun, masked dancers took to the streets, drumming, chanting, defying. This wasn't just a celebration. It was rebellion wrapped in color. From the pounding of goatskin drums in Nassau to the spiritual footwork of Belize's Garifuna, to the haunted masquerade in Jamaica's countryside, Junkanoo is a survival story you can hear. This is a journey through the sound of resistance, the art of endurance, and the cultural heartbeat of the Caribbean diaspora. Welcome to the untold history of the festival that refused to die. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Before Junkanoo burst onto the colonial streets of the Caribbean, before it became the competitive parade spectacle of Nassau or the ritual drum dance of the Garifuna in Belize, it lived in Africa, in the sacred rhythms, masked processions, and spiritual traditions of West African societies. To understand Junkanoo, we must begin in the interior of Ghana, among the Akan people. Their festivals were not just entertainment, they were systems of cultural preservation. Masquerades honored the dead, connected the living with ancestral spirits, and reminded communities of their lineage. These rituals used sound and color not as decoration, but as communication. In the Igbo territories of southeastern Nigeria, secret societies like the Akban Odo used costumed performances to enforce law, settle disputes, and preserve cosmological knowledge. Their ceremonies featured elaborate masks, sacred drumming, symbolic gestures, and storytelling through movement. And among the Yoruba, the Egungun festivals celebrated the spirits of the departed through layered cloth costumes and thunderous drums, each rhythm carrying a spiritual code. These were not mere performances. They were maps of cultural identity, visual languages passed down through generations. But the Atlantic slave trade ripped these traditions from their soil. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, millions of Africans were violently uprooted and brought to the Caribbean. Alongside sugarcane, disease, and rebellion, they brought with them the sacred memory of home. In ships bound for Jamaica, the Bahamas, and Central America, enslaved men and women carried fragments of Egungun, Ekp, Akan, and Mande tradition. These fragments became the bones of Junkanoo. Once in the colonies, enslaved Africans were stripped of language, family, and ritual, but not rhythm. Plantation overseers could silence speech, but they could not erase the memory of the drum. In the dark hours after labor, some communities would recreate forbidden festivals in hushed tones, using conch shells, goatskin drums, cowbells, and carved whistles. Their movements mirrored their ancestors, even as their chains clinked in rhythm. The mask became survival. Hidden behind the anonymity of costume, enslaved Africans could temporarily escape surveillance. In some cases, they even used the guise of celebration to plan revolts or mock their enslavers. These were dangerous, defiant acts disguised as performance. Over time, these rituals fused with the Christian calendar, particularly the rare days off granted around Christmas. What emerged was not a carbon copy of African ceremony, but a creolized evolution, Junkanoo. The earliest colonial records referencing Junkanoo or Junkanoo festivals appear in Jamaica in the 1700s. British travelers described strange masked Negroes performing wild dances in the streets during the Christmas season. They misunderstood what they saw, mistaking defiance for folly, reverence for chaos. But these early Junkanoo performers knew exactly what they were doing. They weren't just entertaining themselves. They were preserving culture under bondage. In the Bahamas, where enslaved people were granted 3 days off around Christmas, Junkanoo became especially rooted. By the 1800s, groups of masked men would march through Nassau, beating drums, blowing horns, and wearing costumes made from flour paste, sponge cloth, and discarded materials. Their processions were loud, unruly, and, to the colonial gaze, threatening. Authorities often tried to suppress them, labeling them uncivilized. But no law could kill the beat. The origins of Junkanoo, though obscured by time, colonial misunderstanding, and forced adaptation, are unmistakably African. They are encoded in the steps of the dancer, in the throb of the drum, in the layered cloth of the costume. Every rhythm, every mask, every chant is a whisper from across the ocean. Today's Junkanoo, with its grand stages, prize money, and glittering floats, is the descendant of resistance. It is the echo of ancestors who refuse to be erased. It is rhythm as rebellion. It is memory in motion. In the 18th and early 19th centuries, the Bahamas was a slave society where African traditions were stripped, censored, and surveilled. Yet even under the crushing brutality of plantation life, enslaved people found space, however fleeting, to express who they were, who they had been, and who they refused to stop being. And that space was Junkanoo. By the mid-1700s, a tradition was taking shape among the enslaved Africans of Nassau. Each year during the Christmas holidays, they were granted a rare privilege: 3 days off from labor. 3 days when no cane was cut, no cargo hauled, and no orders barked. 3 days when they could, for once, flood the streets with the sounds of their ancestors. But these weren't merely festive days. They were acts of cultural resistance. In the darkness of colonial oppression, Junkanoo became a coded rebellion, a way to preserve identity without inviting punishment. Masked and costumed, draped in discarded cloth, sponge, feathers, and mud, the enslaved poured into the city streets. They beat rhythms on goatskin drums and clanged cowbells made from old tools. They blew into conch shells and danced in winding lines that mimicked the sacred processions of their homeland. They called it Junkanoo. The British called it a problem. To colonial eyes, this was madness. The noise, the defiance, the sheer volume of life from people they saw as property was both confusing and frightening. The authorities feared what they could not understand: that the music carried meaning, that the masks had memory, that the celebration was a cry of survival. Periodically, the government attempted to ban it, citing it as a disturbance or riotous behavior. But Junkanoo could not be caged. It adapted. It went underground. It shifted in time and space. But it always returned, louder, sharper, more rooted. It was the only time of year when the enslaved could take ownership of the public streets. A radical reversal of daily power structures. They became the center of attention. Their drums drowned out the silence of subjugation. Their movement replaced their stillness. Their laughter carved open space for joy in a system designed to break the soul. But Junkanoo was not just about escape. It was a deeply layered theater. Costumes often carried hidden satire. Enslaved performers mocked their enslavers by mimicking European fashion in exaggerated, absurd ways. Some took on colonial characters: judges, plantation owners, soldiers, turning them into caricatures. Others embodied spirits and animals from African mythologies. Behind each mask was meaning. Behind each performance was protest. The women played a vital role too. Though the parades were male-dominated in form, women were often behind the construction of costumes and the preparation of musical instruments. Their homes became studios of quiet resistance, spaces where cultural memory was stitched, glued, molded, preserved. Junkanoo became a collective memory. It allowed an entire community, fractured by slavery, divided by pain, to synchronize, to drum as one, to breathe together, to sweat and scream and laugh and mourn, all in the same procession. It was the closest thing they had to freedom. And the colonial authorities knew it. By the early 1800s, tensions rose. Junkanoo was increasingly viewed by the white ruling class as a threat, a festival with too much power, too much noise, too much meaning. Laws were passed to limit the size of the parades. Time restrictions were imposed. In some cases, police violently disrupted the gatherings. But still, every Christmas, the drums returned. Through the beat, enslaved people remembered who they were. Through the costume, they disguised their pain and revealed their spirit. Through the dance, they challenged the gaze of those who said they were nothing more than labor. Junkanoo became an open secret, a rebellion painted in color, a revolution danced to rhythm. And it survived. Because the enslaved people of the Bahamas did more than build empires for others. They built a cultural engine that would outlast empire itself. Junkanoo wasn't permission. It was power. In the year 1834, slavery had officially ended in the British Empire, and in the Bahamas, thousands of formerly enslaved Africans stepped into a freedom that was both triumphant and uncertain. But even as the chains were legally broken, the struggle for identity, dignity, and cultural space continued. And at the heart of that struggle was Junkanoo. In the immediate years after emancipation, Junkanoo remained one of the few surviving African-rooted traditions still practiced in public view. But freedom came with new contradictions. While the festival was no longer restricted by slave codes, it now existed in a society that was quick to suppress any bold displays of black celebration. The colonial government, still dominated by white elites, viewed Junkanoo as unruly and dangerous. They believed that these noisy, costumed processions threatened the new post-slavery order. Freed men and women, now walking the streets on their own terms, were expected to be quiet, docile citizens. But Junkanoo had never been quiet. And it would not be domesticated. Instead, it grew louder. Junkanoo became a canvas for the post-emancipation African Bahamian community to reassert cultural memory. Without formal institutions or land ownership, many used the parade as their political platform, a mobile theater of black expression, creativity, and self-respect. In the colorful swirl of costume and drumbeat, formerly enslaved people told the world, "We are still here. And we have something to say." But colonial discomfort persisted. Throughout the 19th century, Junkanoo faced repeated attempts at control. Laws were passed to restrict noise. Certain instruments, like the conch shell, were banned from parades. Some Junkanoo processions were broken up by police, their participants fined or arrested for disturbing the peace. In response, Junkanoo adapted once again. It became more mobile, more unpredictable, appearing in different neighborhoods, moving quickly from one block to another. At times it took the form of house-to-house masquerading. At others, it re-emerged on the margins of town squares or marketplaces. And still the people came. Even in suppression, Junkanoo pulsed with life. Costumes in this period remained grounded in resourcefulness. Flour paste was still used to stiffen paper. Feathers were collected from butcher scraps. Fabric was stitched from cast-offs and dyed with plant extracts. There was no prize money. No sponsorships. Only pride. Only memory. And yet, the artistry deepened. Designs became more intricate. Masks evolved. New characters emerged, both traditional African figures and Bahamian folk icons. The music incorporated layered percussive patterns and new instruments, including homemade rattles and glass bottles used like bells. Junkanoo's sound was changing, but its soul remained rooted. Socially, it became more than a festival, it was therapy. In a colonial world still designed to erase black dignity, Junkanoo was a loud, joyful refusal. It allowed freed people to gather, to organize, to mourn, and to celebrate the ancestors who did not live to see the chains fall. It was, in a word, sacred. By the late 19th century, even as the colonial elite still frowned upon it, Junkanoo had become a symbol of black cultural survival in the Bahamas. Teachers, dock workers, market women, and church leaders quietly encouraged its preservation. Elders passed down drum patterns and costume secrets. Young men formed informal groups to practice routines. Communities gathered to rehearse in alleyways, on porches, behind churches. Junkanoo had become a living classroom. It taught history without textbooks, rhythm without notation, pride without permission. It was no longer just a parade. It was a spiritual archive. The post-emancipation era of Junkanoo was raw, communal, and fiercely defiant. It was a declaration that African traditions, though battered by slavery and colonialism, would not be buried. And with every passing decade, the people made sure the drums would not stop. By the early 20th century, Junkanoo had endured slavery, colonial suspicion, and post-emancipation suppression. But now it was entering a new phase. One that would change its shape, scale, and significance forever. Junkanoo was no longer merely an underground tradition of resistance. It was slowly, and not without tension, becoming a national institution. The road to recognition was neither straight nor smooth. In the early decades of the 1900s, Junkanoo still operated largely outside the framework of official culture. While black Bahamians kept the tradition alive in backstreets and alleyways, the white colonial elite continued to dismiss it as rowdy or primitive. Newspapers of the time often referred to Junkanoo as mob-like or disruptive. Yet despite these insults, the parades persisted. What changed everything was the power of community organizing. By the 1930s and 40s, informal Junkanoo gangs or groups began forming more deliberately, not just as neighborhood collectives but as artistic units. Groups like the Saxons and Valley Boys would later emerge as legends. But even in these early years, men and women were developing choreography, costume planning, and thematic storytelling that pushed Junkanoo into a higher artistic realm. They were no longer just participating. they were innovating. By mid-century, the energy around Junkanoo could not be ignored. The Bahamas was changing, economically, politically, and socially. As the push for Black Bahamian political rights intensified, cultural identity became a weapon of legitimacy. Junkanoo, long considered a nuisance by colonial authorities, began to be reimagined as something powerful, a unique Bahamian treasure. And so began the process of institutionalization. In the 1950s and 60s, a new generation of Black Bahamian leaders and educators began to advocate for Junkanoo as part of the country's cultural heritage. They argued that what was once mocked as backward was in fact a vital expression of national identity. In schools, Junkanoo music and costume making started to be introduced into the curriculum. Local councils began allocating small funds to support Junkanoo events. But the biggest shift came with tourism. As the Bahamas emerged as a premier Caribbean travel destination, government officials and tourism boards began to realize that Junkanoo wasn't just culture. It was currency. Its colors, energy, and unique sound could be marketed, promoted, monetized. Suddenly, Junkanoo was not only welcome on the streets of Nassau, it was being put on stage. This dual recognition, as both national symbol and tourist attraction, created both opportunity and tension. On one hand, Junkanoo artists now had access to more resources. Costume designs became more elaborate, incorporating cardboard frameworks, crepe paper layering, and moving parts. Brass sections were added to traditional goatskin drum ensembles, creating a more complex and cinematic sound. But on the other hand, commercialization threatened the tradition's soul. Some veterans of Junkanoo warned that the introduction of prize money, corporate sponsorships, and government regulations could dilute the spirit of the festival. Others feared that themes would become less political, less historical, and more entertaining to fit the expectations of foreign audiences. Still, Junkanoo persisted, evolving but never forgetting its roots. Today, the two major Junkanoo parades, held annually on Boxing Day, December 26, and New Year's Day, are massive events. Nassau's Bay Street transforms into a riot of sound and spectacle. Groups rehearse for months. Costumes, often costing thousands of dollars and taking hundreds of hours to build, are judged on originality, craftsmanship, and storytelling. Musical performances are scored. Choreography is scrutinized. Winners are crowned. It's competition. It's art. It's history in motion. And it's still community-driven. Despite its global exposure and state funding, Junkanoo remains fiercely local. Families hand down costume-making techniques. Neighborhoods rally behind their groups. Children grow up learning the beat of the cowbell before they can spell their name. Even those who don't march still contribute, painting backdrops, sewing cloth, mixing glue, cooking food for the team. In every corner of Bahamian life, Junkanoo is present. At weddings. At funerals. In schools. In protest. It has become more than a parade. It is a living language of Bahamian identity. From the margins of colonial disapproval to the heart of national celebration, Junkanoo's journey mirrors the struggle of the people who created it. It is a story of cultural resistance transformed into cultural dominance, not through war or decree but through rhythm, color, and joy. Junkanoo is no longer asking for a seat at the table. It is the table. Today, Junkanoo in the Bahamas is an explosion of sound, motion, and spirit, a living monument to cultural resilience that pulses through the streets of Nassau like ancestral thunder. No longer confined to back alleys or the margins of society, Junkanoo now stands proudly as the centerpiece of Bahamian identity. But make no mistake, though it now shines in the spotlight, its soul still belongs to the people. In the modern era, Junkanoo has become a grand, orchestrated spectacle. Months before the big parades, communities come alive with preparations. Backyards are transformed into makeshift costume shops. Young boys learn how to bend wire frames from their uncles. Grandmothers sit on porches, tying strips of crepe paper with aching hands. Entire neighborhoods become creative laboratories. And when December arrives, the city transforms. Bay Street, the ceremonial heart of Nassau, is blocked off and barricaded. Massive sound systems are tested. Bleachers rise like Colosseum walls. At midnight on Boxing Day, the air fills with the rhythmic gallop of goatskin drums, the metallic chime of cowbells, the piercing shriek of whistles, and the roar of brass bands blaring into the warm Caribbean night. This isn't just a party, it's war. Cultural war. Creative war. A battle between groups like the Valley Boys, the Saxons, One Family, Roots, and Genesis, all vying for dominance in categories such as best music, best choreography, best costume, and best overall presentation. Every costume is a feat of engineering. Designed around elaborate wire frameworks, they are covered in paper, feathers, sequins, mirrors, and foam sculptures. Some include movable parts, spinning suns, waving hands, wings that stretch 15 feet wide. They are not worn so much as carried, often strapped to the body or pushed on wheels. Some pieces take an entire team just to maneuver. But behind the pageantry is story. Each group selects a theme, often drawing from Bahamian folklore, African mythology, Caribbean history, or global events. These aren't random designs, they are narrative sculptures. Junkanooers don't just dance, they speak through performance. They shout history through color. They sing resistance with every step. And when the judges tally their scores and the crowd roars for the winners, it isn't just about pride. It's about legacy. It's about which community told the strongest story, honored the ancestors, and moved the nation's soul. Junkanoo today is a layered cultural engine. It fuels the economy with costume designers, musicians, fabric vendors, hoteliers, and food sellers all playing a part. It fuels education with schools incorporating Junkanoo studies into their curricula. And it fuels national unity, serving as a rare moment where all Bahamians, regardless of class, religion, or political party, come together for the same rhythm. Still, tensions remain. Some argue that the intense competition has commercialized the tradition too far, that prize money, sponsorships, and media contracts have dulled the deeper spiritual edge of Junkanoo. Others counter that evolution is necessary, that the festival's growth ensures its survival in a modern world. Both may be true. What is clear is that Junkanoo has become the emotional heartbeat of the Bahamas. It is performed at independence celebrations, at state funerals, at international cultural expos. It has reached stages in the United States, the United Kingdom, and across the Caribbean, but it remains most potent on Bay Street in the dark before dawn when the drums begin to speak. In that moment, Junkanoo becomes something ancient and new all at once. A child in face paint dances beside a grandfather who remembers when Junkanoo was outlawed. A costume glistens with beads and sweat under floodlights. A horn blares and the crowd rises. It is past midnight, but the city is alive. And through it all, the deeper purpose remains. To remember. To resist. To rejoice. Junkanoo today is not a copy of Africa. Nor is it a product of colonial survival alone. It is something Caribbean. Something Bahamian. It is an Afro-Caribbean epic written in rhythm and spectacle. And it is still evolving. From rebellion to ritual, from punishment to pride, Junkanoo has become the rhythm of a nation. While the Bahamas holds the global spotlight for its vibrant Junkanoo parades, the roots of this cultural tradition stretch beyond its borders, into the hills, markets, and rural crossroads of Jamaica. Here, under different names and in quieter forms, Junkanoo, also spelled Junkanoo, Junkanoo, or Junkanoo, still lingers. A shadow of the past, an echo of a defiant spirit that once shook the streets. To understand Junkanoo in Jamaica, one must return to the 1700s, the height of British colonial rule. Enslaved Africans, like those in the Bahamas, were granted a brief window of freedom around Christmas. With their limited time and resources, they created a masquerade, a traveling performance that fused African spiritual traditions with satire, symbolism, and subversion. It was loud. It was unsettling. It was unforgettable. Masked dancers stormed through townships and plantations, beating drums, blowing horns, and taunting white colonists with grotesque portrayals of authority figures. The characters they embodied were complex, part parody, part power. Among them were Pitchy Patchy, a trickster figure clad in a suit made of colorful strips of cloth, symbolizing the chaos and unpredictability of resistance. The Horsehead, a half-man, half-beast who danced and bucked wildly, a nod to African hybrid deities and a jab at the colonial cavalry. The Devil, a horned figure with a forked tail, often meant to challenge or mock the religious strictures imposed by missionaries. The Warrior or Cowhead, often carrying a whip or stick representing strength, African nobility, and ancestral memory. These were not costumes for celebration alone. They were living icons of cultural resistance. As Jangkanu processions moved through towns like Spanish Town, Kingston, and Montego Bay, they disturbed the established order. They took over white spaces, transformed silence into rhythm, and turned pain into performance. The colonial elite viewed them as both a curiosity and a threat, sometimes tolerated, more often criminalized. Over time, as Jamaica's social fabric changed, so too did Jangkanu. The 19th century brought both emancipation and a push toward Victorian morality. New missionary-led schools and institutions began to distance themselves from what they labeled heathen festivals. Jangkanu, with its roots in African cosmology and raw street theater, was deemed indecent. It was pushed out of urban centers and into rural strongholds. There it survived, not in parades but in memory. In small towns and sugar estate villages, the Jangkanu spirit persisted. At Christmas, bands of children and young men still dressed up in masks and rags, recreating the rhythms and steps they had seen their grandparents perform. The instruments were simple: drums made from animal skins stretched over hollow logs, bamboo fifes, and makeshift shakers. Sometimes even the bare hands and feet did the drumming. But unlike the well-funded, televised grandeur of Bahamian Jangkanu, Jamaican Jangkanu became a ritual of remembrance, quieter, humbler, more fragile. In the 20th century, Jangkanu appeared only occasionally in public, during national celebrations, folklore events, or cultural school days. While its spirit never died, it was now a relic, a ghost of what had once challenged colonial power in the streets. And yet, Jangkanu remains a vital thread in Jamaica's cultural fabric. It is the ancestor of performance forms like street theater, roots plays, and even aspects of dancehall stagecraft. The theatricality, the defiance, the subversive costuming, all these elements echo in Jamaica's modern artistic expressions. Today, efforts are underway to revive Jangkanu. Cultural groups, folklorists, and educators in parishes like St. Mary, Portland, and Clarendon have begun teaching children about its roots, reconstructing costumes, and reintroducing the characters into local parades and Christmas festivals. Still, the question lingers: why did Jangkanu fade in Jamaica while Jangkanu exploded in the Bahamas? The answer lies in national structure, state support, and public perception. In the Bahamas, Jangkanu was eventually embraced by the state, promoted through tourism, and financially supported. In Jamaica, Jangkanu remained orphaned, respected by folklorists but left out of the national spotlight. And yet, its legacy lives on, not in grandeur but in grit. Jangkanu in Jamaica reminds us that resistance takes many forms. Sometimes it marches down Bay Street with horns blazing. Other times, it dances barefoot down a dirt road in Clarendon with a paper mask and a memory. In the quiet coastal villages of southern Belize, where the land meets the Caribbean Sea and the sky breaks into endless blue, a different kind of Jangkanu beats. Here it is called Jangkanu. And unlike the glittering parades of Nassau or the fading street theater of Jamaican Jangkanu, Jangkanu in Belize carries the full spiritual weight of survival, a sacred echo of Afro-Indigenous resistance preserved by the Garifuna people. To understand Jangkanu in Belize, one must first understand the Garifuna. The Garifuna are the descendants of shipwrecked West Africans who intermarried with the native Kalinago, Caribs, on the island of St. Vincent in the 1600s. Together, they resisted British and French colonization with ferocity and vision, forming a new, unique identity: Afro-Indigenous, fiercely proud, deeply spiritual. But in 1797, after decades of war, the British exiled the Garifuna from St. Vincent. Survivors were deported to the coast of Central America, primarily to Honduras, Guatemala, and what is now Belize. There, despite immense hardship, the Garifuna rebuilt, preserving their language, music, food, and ritual life. At the heart of this cultural preservation is Jangkanu. Each year, during the Christmas and New Year season, Garifuna communities, particularly in the towns of Dangriga and Punta Gorda, come alive with the pounding of segunda and primero drums. Masked dancers dressed in white, wearing headdresses and tight-fitting pants, parade through the streets to the syncopated rhythm of ancestral beats. Their movements are sharp, precise, almost military. Yet within every step is spirit. The Jangkanu dancer is not just performing, he is embodying memory. These dancers often wear carved wooden masks with exaggerated features, and their costumes mimic the British colonial military style: buttoned shirts, sashes, and mock epaulettes. but the intent is not to honor the colonizer. It is to subvert him. To dance in the costume of the oppressor is to reclaim power, to mock the false majesty of empire, to retell history from the feet upward. Unlike other forms of junkanoo, Belize's junkanoo is not primarily a spectacle. It is sacred theater. Each performance is spiritual, tied to the dugu, ancestral rituals that honor the dead, cleanse the soul and heal generational trauma. Drums are not merely instruments, they are conduits to the spirit world. Songs are not for entertainment, they are invocations. The dancers, often male but supported by a chorus of women and elders, take their role seriously. To lead a junkanoo procession is to lead a procession of ghosts and guardians. The ritual begins in the early morning, often with a gathering of community members at a family home. From there, the dancers move from house to house, stopping to perform, bless, and receive offerings, food, drink, coins, prayers. It is not unlike a pilgrimage. For many Garifuna, junkanoo is a direct link to the ancestors who endured the Middle Passage, survived exile, and kept the culture alive through centuries of displacement. And yet, despite its depth, junkanoo remains underrepresented in national narratives. While Belize is officially multi-ethnic with Garifuna culture recognized as a national treasure, the nuances of junkanoo are rarely fully understood by those outside the community. It is often labeled a Christmas tradition, stripped of its spiritual significance. But inside the Garifuna world, junkanoo is more than Christmas. It is resistance. It is survival. It is self-definition. Efforts are now being made to preserve and elevate junkanoo. Cultural activists, musicians, and elders are documenting the oral histories behind the dances. Schools in Garifuna communities teach children not just the steps but the meanings. Ethnomusicologists record the drum patterns to ensure they are not lost. And across Belize, Garifuna voices are rising, reminding the nation and the world that this isn't just performance. It is a sacred echo. Junkanoo is perhaps the most spiritually intact descendant of the broader junkanoo tradition. Where others have leaned into carnival spectacle or folkloric revival, the Garifuna have remained protectors of the spirit within the mask. And so, on a quiet December morning in Dangriga, when the drums begin to beat and the masked dancers take to the streets, the air trembles with more than rhythm. It trembles with history. It trembles with resistance. It trembles with the voices of the ancestors, who were never meant to survive but did. Across the Bahamas, Jamaica, and Belize, a single rhythm echoes, one born in African soil, carried across the Atlantic in chains and reshaped by generations of resistance. It is the rhythm of junkanoo, 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 different names, different forms, but bound by a shared historical memory. And as we step back from each unique expression, a larger truth emerges. This is not just a festival. It is a cultural survival system, a coded language of the African diaspora in the Caribbean. What began as massed rebellion during slavery has become, depending on geography and history, a national parade, a rural masquerade, or a spiritual rite. The differences matter. But so do the connections. Common threads. At their core, all forms of junkanoo share five elements. West African roots. Whether the inspiration came from Egungun ceremonies, Akan festivals, or masquerade societies like Ekp, the ancestral foundation is unmistakable. Drums, masks, dance, and oral storytelling were central to African communal life, and they remain central in junkanoo's DNA. Christmastime expression. These festivals emerged in the only window enslaved Africans were allowed to gather freely, the Christmas holidays. In those precious few days, they reclaimed time, space, and identity, turning a colonial loophole into an act of spiritual defiance. Masking and costuming. Across all three countries, the mask has always been more than disguise. It's a shield. A mirror. A form of transformation. Costumes became vehicles for storytelling, spiritual invocation, or social satire, using scraps, feathers, flower paste, and ingenuity. Drum-based music and movement. The drum is not a background instrument in junkanoo. It is the heartbeat. From the goatskin rhythms of the Bahamas to the Garifuna drum duets of Belize, the soundscape of junkanoo speaks without words, inviting the body to remember what the mind was taught to forget. Cultural resistance and identity. Most importantly, these traditions were never just about entertainment. They were tools of survival, subtle and sometimes not so subtle, protests against erasure. They gave enslaved and later freed African-descended people a platform to affirm their identity in a world that denied their humanity. Key differences. In the Bahamas, Junkanoo evolved into a nationally recognized institution. It is large, competitive, highly funded, and deeply intertwined with national identity and tourism. It is both a stage for artistry and a symbol of Bahamian pride, though critics debate how commercialization has affected its soul. In Jamaica, Junkanoo declined in prominence but remains a folk tradition, resurfacing during cultural festivals and in rural Christmas celebrations. Its theatrical characters like Pitchy Patchy, Horse Head, and Devil reflect deep African symbolism and colonial critique, even if the wider population has forgotten their origins. In Belize, Junkanoo remains sacred and spiritual, deeply woven into Garifuna cosmology. It is not a show but a rite. Every dance, every mask, every drumbeat carries ancestral weight. It is less about visibility and more about preservation, memory, and honoring the dead. Why did the paths diverge? The divergence lies in political will, cultural policies, demographic shifts, and tourism economies. The Bahamian state chose to invest in Junkanoo as a unifying symbol. Jamaica, with its rich tapestry of competing musical and cultural traditions, from maroon drum rituals to Rastafarian Nyabingi, allowed Junkanoo to fade. Belize, with its smaller Garifuna population, held onto Junkanoo tightly, as a lifeline to a threatened identity. And yet, all three carry the same ancestral flame. The diaspora's cultural mirror. Junkanoo, in all its forms, is a mirror of the African diaspora's journey. Stolen and scattered, yet unbroken. Erased in law, yet remembered in rhythm. Pushed to the margins, yet always returning, louder and brighter. As migration patterns shift and Caribbean people carry their traditions to cities like Miami, Toronto, London, and New York, Junkanoo travels too, evolving, adapting, but never forgetting. A Bahamian child learning the drum in Nassau, a Jamaican teen sewing strips of cloth in Portland, a Garifuna elder teaching the sacred steps in Dangriga, all are part of the same unbroken story. It is a story of resilience and reinvention. A story where the enslaved became creators, where the marginalized became maestros, where memory became movement. And as long as the drums are played, on Boxing Day, on Christmas morning, in hidden courtyards and stadium parades, the spirit of Junkanoo lives. Because Junkanoo is not just history. It is prophecy. A reminder that no matter the oppression, the culture will dance again.